This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Folks, it is truly a great honor of mine to welcome to the program CBS News correspondent, journalist Kimberly Dozier. Hey, Kimberly.
Hello there, Coy. Very nice to be here with you on the air.
Absolutely. Well, welcome back.
Nice to be here at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And welcome back to Charlottesville, if by voice only. We're so glad to have you with us. And just the first thing I want to say is thank God you're alive.
I've been saying that one a lot myself. And the more I found out over the past 3 months, meeting all the doctors who were involved in the initial care on the ground, keeping me alive, and the guys from the 4th Infantry Division Patrol who kept us in one piece, it's amazing how close a few of us came. And it was just because of the medics and the soldiers on the ground and all those trauma surgeons that I'm still here to talk about it.
Well, let's, before we get started into some of the details, let's hit sort of the local angle here. It's been quite a while since we were hanging out at St. Martin's on the UVA corner.
Absolutely. But plotting how we were going to take over the media, the world media.
That's right. And you are, most folks might not know this, but you were the star of a very short-lived cable access TV program called Barefoot Excursions.
Indeed.
And we put you in front of the camera and sent you, what did we do? We sent you to Baskin-Robbins.
Well, yeah, the idea was it was a comedy segment, and I was going to go into Baskin-Robbins and just keep asking them for another flavor to see, you know, what's the limit? There must be some, like, unwritten limit. You can't ask for more than 4 or 5. But as I recall, the joke was on us. The person behind the counter, we hadn't anticipated how they would react to having a camera in the room. And what they did was they piled more ice cream than any one human being could eat on each of the spoons and just kept handing me another and handing me another.
And we would, you'd look at us and say, another one? Go, Kimberly, go! And you're like, I don't know if I can do another one.
I didn't want to see ice cream for the next 2 weeks.
Kimberly Dozier from CBS News is my guest, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Let's first plug very unshamelessly here. This coming Tuesday night at 10 p.m., Flashpoint, it's an hour-long special with you and Katie Couric telling this really, truly amazing story of what happened to you and to Paul and James and some others
camera
there.
Crew.
Right, right. Tell us about this special, how long you've been working on it, and what folks can expect when they tune in on Tuesday evening.
Well, it all started in the process of recovery. Any trauma victim out there, whether you get injured in a blast injury in a war or you have a horrible car crash and walk away from it, you want to know what happened, and you track down the details. Now, when a reporter goes through something like that, it's asking questions times 10. And so from the moment I opened my eyes, I was trying to figure out what happened, who was where, why did this happen. And I spent last fall tracking down everyone I could who'd been at the scene, who'd been at the Baghdad Casualty Hospital, the Balad Trauma Center that we were sent to after Baghdad, and then Landstuhl. And I came up with some amazing stories, not about me, but about all the people who worked on me and what happened to the other guys who were all around me who were hit by this wall of shrapnel from the car bomb. And I approached Susan Zirinsky, who is the producer of 48 Hours, but also the producer of a lot of CBS's documentaries like 9/11 and one on the Beslan Massacre. And she said, okay, we can do an hour on this. And what we did was we tracked down, we started on me, used me as a passport, as a way to get into the story. I show you some stuff that's very, it's very personal, it's pretty invasive, it's hard for me to watch. You see me, thanks to a CNN crew that was filming when I came in, you see me screaming on the operating table. You also see the soldiers screaming on their operating tables. And you use my story as a passport to get to them. And it starts on me, but it ends up on the 4th Infantry Division guys who survived that day. Some of them have gotten well enough that they want to go back to Iraq with their battle buddies. Others are not ready yet. One guy in particular, the sergeant who was standing next to me, Justin Farrar. Justin's place was always by Captain Funkhauser's side. Captain Alex Funkhauser is the officer we were following that day, and he was killed instantly by the blast. And the captain had said, just before we got out of the Humvees, he'd said to Justin, you stay back with her. You protect her this time. And he still blames himself for not being at his captain's side. And we also met Captain Funkhauser's wife, Jennifer, who is an amazing woman. I can't believe that the strength that she's shown in the face of this and the way that she lives her life to be an example to their two young daughters is that's where the whole show ends up. And if you can use me to get to that, then it's been well worth the journey.
CBS News correspondent journalist Kimberly Dozier is my guest today, the first hour here on Charlottesville Right Now. Kimberly, let's begin, I guess, with May 29th, 2006, as a sort of a backstory. How is it that you came to find yourself waking up that day in Baghdad?
Well, I'd turned into a bit of a regular Baghdad correspondent when I first got the job with the CBS network side of things. I'd been a radio correspondent for a long time, and I'd been a correspondent for the affiliate news services. That means you end up on all of the local news channels across the states and the local news TV. But I'd finally made the leap right after the invasion of Baghdad over to network. And they said, you know, okay, basically, there's your desk, good luck. And I looked around and realized there weren't many ways to get on the air. And I called the London bureau chief and said, well, how do I make air? There's not much going on in Israel. And he said, well, you know, everything in Baghdad's winding down, so no one wants to be there very much anymore. So that's how I ended up being there two-thirds of the year for about 3 years in a row until I was hit by that car bomb.
I remember early last year, we were sending emails back and forth, mm-hmm. and we were trying to figure out what would be a good time to get you on this program.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of the emails that you sent referenced a bunch of shrapnel hitting the side of the building that you were living in.
Oh, yeah, that was normal.
And tell us about how this was sort of and has been and continues to be normal for the journalists over there.
Well, for the journalists, but more important for ordinary Iraqis, there is no part of that city that is, you could say there are large parts of the country that are peaceful, but the areas that you see on TV and the major population areas are often riven with violence. Baghdad is the worst of it. And you have, from morning to night and through the night, you can hear explosions across the city. They echo off the buildings so that you don't know whether it was a car bomb far away or a small roadside bomb, but really near to you. And because of all of this stuff that's flying, every once in a while, you're on the receiving end of it. A rocket aimed at the green zone, well, they've got to aim the rocket arc from one particular favorite firing position. They've got to aim it over our hotel. Sometimes it falls short, and the rockets land in our parking lot. And there are other things that are just peculiar to Iraq and to the Middle East. The policemen at the nearby intersection right near our hotel, well, they like to clear traffic by just randomly firing AK-47 rounds into the air. So probably one of the most dangerous things that we do is a stand-up out on the roof. Now, that's the piece that you do to camera when you're, you know, saying, here I am in Baghdad with the backdrop behind you. And that roof where we stand is littered with spent AK-47 bullets just from the cops clearing traffic. So, you know, there are a lot of things in Baghdad that can kill you. There's a reason they call it one of the most dangerous places on earth.
Kimberly, May 29th, 2006, you and your team got up and went out to do a regular Memorial Day in the life. Here is what our soldiers are doing on Memorial Day, and it was supposed to be a routine tour. Where exactly were you headed?
Well, we didn't know when we first headed out. We knew it was going to be in central Baghdad, but the military, because of the security situation, because every phone call is potentially listened to by the other side, whoever the other side is, hadn't told us the exact neighborhood. But when we got there, we first met our officer that we were going to be following, a man named Captain James Alex Funkhauser. He went by his middle name, Alex. And he told us we'd be going to the Corrada. Well, there was an instant sense of relief. The Corrada is one of the safest parts, or had been one of the safest parts of Baghdad, if there is such a thing. And we were going to survey these areas where the Americans were going to be handing checkpoints over to Iraqi control. The reason they were handing the checkpoints over? Because the areas were deemed safe enough for green troops to be able to handle. So our first stop was going to be in this general location, and we were going to be talking to Iraqis. The captain wanted to talk to Iraqis who may have witnessed an incident in that neighborhood the day before, a roadside bomb that had been aimed at Iraqi troops. So there we were. We thought, okay, typical story. Iraqis stand up, U.S. troops stand down in a relatively safe neighborhood, but hey, we've got a great guy to follow. Captain Funkhauser was eloquent, articulate, and he didn't mince his words when he talked about the problems that he faced in getting some of these Iraqi soldiers, Iraqi policemen, to know how to do their jobs. And we set out with a sense of, Paul and James and I had a bit of a powwow beforehand. Paul Douglas and James Brolin were my cameraman and sound man, and we thought, okay, great, we've got a good soldier to follow. And, okay, we're going to be going to your run-of-the-mill neighborhood, so we're not going to see a whole bunch. But we really have to capture his interaction with Iraqis, because that's going to be good. And with that, we all got in our Humvees. We got to the first stop. We must have been out of the Humvees for not more than 3 or 4 minutes, just milling around. And the captain was talking to me as they looked for Iraqis to start quizzing about this incident from the day before. And out of the corner of his eye, Captain Funkhauser saw that his Iraqi translator, Sam, had found some people to talk to around a tea stand. And with that, the captain, it didn't matter that he was, you know, walking along the street talking to a network TV reporter. He saw his mission ahead of him, and he just left me in the dust. And if he hadn't, at that moment, decided that his mission was more important than talking to some reporter, if he'd let us walk along and kept talking to me, I'd be dead right now. But it's his dedication, in a sense, that saved me. So I was sort of hanging back because I thought, perfect. I could see Paul and James moving into position to get the shot of Captain Funkhauser, arm outstretched, walking up to these Iraqis, getting ready to say the usual salamu alaikum, and that's the moment when I could see the Iraqis look rather tense, seeing this American soldier approach them, and it was about to be that moment when the captain says a friendly greeting and the tension dissolves, and that is the instant that the car bomb hit. Now, Captain Funkhauser and his translator Sam were killed instantly. James was killed instantly. Paul, they tried to save. They were all about 10 to 15 feet from a car bomb that had been parked among parked cars just across from the T-stand. So someone had been watching and waiting, and all of us got close enough. We walked into the kill zone, and that's when they blew it up.
So this was not a suicide bomber. It was triggered remotely by somebody who was watching the scene.
Yes, the commander of the 4th Infantry Division, who had okayed this mission, later told me that he believes that we were a target of opportunity, that street was normally patrolled by Iraqis, and that car bomb had been left there to just catch any Iraqi patrol that went through. And imagine their satisfaction when instead they got a bunch of American soldiers followed by a foreign camera team.
My guest is CBS News correspondent Kimberly Dozier, the subject of a special coming up on Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Flashpoint with Katie Couric. Kimberly, do you have any memory of the explosion?
I do. I remember about 10 minutes afterwards. The explosion itself was like getting slammed into blackness. I couldn't tell which direction it came from. If you've ever been knocked in the head really hard, you almost see stars. It was like that times 100. And I, at the next moment, I don't know how long that moment was, I opened my eyes and saw a burning car. I was on my back, and I could feel burning on my legs, and I thought the burning car was the reason, though it was several feet from me. And I started calling for help, calling for someone to pull me away from the burning car, because I couldn't move. And I know someone dragged me away, don't know who, couldn't see. And then a very calm voice started talking to me, someone saying, "Ma'am, I'm going to tie tourniquets on you. I'm going to tie a tourniquet on your left leg." And that was the voice of Staff Sergeant Jeremy Koch. Now, you probably haven't heard of these guys. There was an Iowa National Guard patrol that was just driving by when the bomb hit us. They screeched to a halt, whipped back around. It was a 4 Humvee patrol. One of their medic and one of the sergeants ran out immediately while the rest of them set up a security perimeter. And basically, once they secured the area, the rest of them ran in and everyone took a casualty. So the 4th Infantry Division patrol we were with, all of them who were still standing were working on someone. The Iowa guys were working on someone. There were 6 soldiers on the ground. They were still trying to save Paul and me. So that's a lot of holes to plug. That's a lot of people to try to keep alive.
So you have a, Kimberly Dozier is my guest, you have a brief memory there, just a few minutes after the blast.
Talking to him, asking him if my helmet was on, because I could hear the car bomb. Well, I thought it was the car bomb cooking off. It turns out it was ammunition in a Humvee that had caught fire from the force of the blast, and that was cooking off. And I kept saying, "Is my helmet on? Because if it's not on, I don't want to get hit by any shrapnel." And he must have been looking down at the rest of me and going, "Lady, you've already been hit by shrapnel." But he kindly didn't tell me that. I did ask him, "Where are my guys? How are my guys?" And I heard him talk over top of me to someone else. She's asking about her guys. And he told me later when I got to meet him, he said the soldier just pointed to James and Paul, who died by then. And he realized what had happened. He just turned back to me and he said, "They're fine. They're fine." It took a long time for me to find out. It wasn't until I opened my eyes in Landstuhl, and I couldn't talk because I had a tube down my throat, and I motioned for pen and paper. And my ICU nurse tells me the first thing I wrote was, "Where's my camera crew?" And they had another debate, and then finally my family said, "You've got to tell her if she's asking." And that's when my producer finally told me what happened to them.
Of course, Paul Douglas, cameraman, and James Brolin, your sound man, both died that day. You were rushed to a field hospital where it just turns out there happened to be a CNN crew there videotaping, and they actually got footage of you on the table.
They had no idea what they were filming. They had been covering the CASH, the casualty hospital in Baghdad, for several months, and they knew that a mass casualty incident was coming in. Lots of people on stretchers. And Cal said, as he was filming me, Cal Perry, the Baghdad bureau chief, was one of the guys with a little DV camera. And he'd only met me a couple days before at a press luncheon. And so he said he was filming me and thought, you know, this is strange, some civilian woman in a red shirt. And so they filmed me being stretched out of the Humvee, taken into the hospital, and the doctors start working on me. And he said it wasn't until they turned me over that and he saw the mic flag, the little microphone that was still pinned on my shirt, covered in blood, that he knew who it was. And he still has trouble with that day. But to his credit, and I'm glad for me, because now I'm ready to watch it, he kept filming. And you see the doctors working to save me, 2 soldiers who were in the surgical room with me, and in the next room, 3 other soldiers. There were a lot of us who were, we'd lost a lot of blood. We drained the blood bank, and the call went out. And, you know, the shell-shocked soldiers from the patrol who just brought in their injured buddies just all lined up and gave blood. And it's thanks to that and the surgeons there that I'm alive today.
CBS News correspondent Kimberly Dozier is my guest. your recovery is nothing short of miraculous. And of course, you point out, and it can't be underscored enough, that it is due to the fact of some very talented and dedicated people, a lot of talented and dedicated people, not just there right after the blast, but over this past year, physical therapists, counselors, people who have stepped forward to help you and others recover from this blast. What has the past year been like for you?
One very, very long and painful journey, parts of it. It took a long time to find out, would I walk again? It took many, many weeks before I could even stand, and doctors didn't know. They never know. They fix you as well as they can, but then it's up to you working with a physiotherapist to make good on their work. And in the beginning, last fall, when I was first discharged from the hospital, I could go 10 steps with a walker. And then it was after 2 weeks in a physiotherapy hospital, it was 100 steps with a cane. It took a long time to get to the point where I was walking unaided, and it took a good 6 months before I could finally get back to running. So that was the physical side of it, and there was also some more surgery involved, which meant, you know, some setbacks along the way. But then there's the whole emotional side is, you know, that for some people, the day keeps coming back to them. Now, I was lucky. I'm a reporter. I have the gift of the gab. From the moment I opened my eyes, I was talking about what I remembered and trying to find out more. One of the psychotherapists I got to see in Bethesda, they tried to give me, you know, Prozac and things like that, and I refused. I said, I need someone to talk to. And they sent what I call the Air Force's Dr. Phil in to talk to me. He apologized. He's like, look, I normally talk to Marines, so I'm probably going to swear a lot. And after talking to me for about 10 minutes, he's like, great, okay, I see we can do a lot of good work here, but here's the thing. Sometimes I'm going to have to shut you up, because unlike all the Marines and the soldiers on this hall, you have the opposite problem. You talk too much. So apparently, though, talking is good for you. By the time I left, he said, you know, you don't have any signs of PTSD. Here's the checklist. Watch for it. You know, don't call me. See ya. And that has, along the way, as I've met some of the other soldiers who went through that day, some of them didn't have the same outlet, or some of them didn't have the same willingness to bring some of this into the light. And, you know, when you bring some of the painful stuff up to the surface, you sort of rob it of its power. You'll see in the special, one of the guys, the guy who was wounded next to me, Sergeant Justin Farrar, he tried to hold it in for a long time, and he suffered severe post-traumatic stress because of it. And he's now finally taking the steps to get over it. But, you know, that's several months down the line. He's still haunted by some of the nightmares, and he's still haunted by the guilt that he didn't protect his captain that day, that his captain died and he's still here.
CBS News correspondent Kimberly Dozier is my guest, the subject of a special Flashpoint, 10 p.m. this coming Tuesday night with Katie Couric. Kimberly, what now? You're back at work. What are your plans? It's been reported that you have interest in returning to cover the Middle East. You have been one of the very best reporters, in my opinion, in the Middle East, bringing news of that region and serving this country so well, keeping us informed about what is happening. Not every journalist that gets over there really understands the region as deeply and as well as you do. What are your plans?
Well, you know, that's one of the things I was studying at UVA, Islamic affairs and the history of that area. So that is a part of the world that I love, where I feel at home. I do want to go back to reporting the Middle East. I still have a house in Jerusalem that I haven't been able to see for a year through all this recovery. And in terms of going back to Iraq, however, that's something that I'd have to run past my family. They've gone through a horrible time the past year watching me recover from this. And, you know, there were moments when it was so touch and go. So the Middle East, yes. Baghdad Foot Patrol, I'll get back to you later.
Kimberly Dozier of CBS News. The last question I have is, if we can just pull back with a wide lens here, help us understand what's going on in the Middle East, if you can. This, you know, we see headlines.
Oh, this is a short question, right?
Yeah. if you could make any sense out of this, you know, for this country to understand what is for so many of us so incredibly perplexing. And we hear these phrases thrown around, you know, Islamic radicalism and war on terror. And from somebody who has not only been there, but who has suffered and fought back from incredible violence, what is your take on what's happening?
Well, at the risk of shorthanding it to the point that I make it inaccurate, to draw a broad brushstroke, often America's best intentions are perceived in an entirely different way in other parts of the world. It's all a matter of how you offer your help. If you offer your help in a way that no one's allowed to say no, you're going to be seen as... in this case, some of our policies in places like Egypt or in places like Jordan, or even the White House's policies to try to change Syria's ways, or Iran, are seen by people on the ground as not efforts to help them to a better life or to help their governments to see their way to different behavior. They're seen as, people on the ground see us as the big swaggering bully with a club. That is so often how we're perceived. And when I talk to somebody at a coffee shop in Amman or a restaurant in Dubai, and you sit and talk with educated people who've lived all over the world, they say, why do you people think you can tell us what to do? That is what is so often the perception in that part of the world of us, and therefore it filters down to a feeling that they got to fight back, and there are all sorts of different ways of fighting back. There are many that we in this part of the world don't find valid, but in that part of the world they do, and that's the kind of dilemma we get stuck in. Some of the soldiers, some of the commanders I've met in Iraq over the years, especially as they've come back several times for different tours, have said, oh, if we knew then what we know now, we would have done things differently. We would have presented things differently. We would have done it in a way that wasn't perceived as so high-handed. And I think it's fantastic that sometimes when I talk to officers now, they know more than I do about that part of the world. But as one general put it to me, have we learned too late? You know, how long are we going to be paying for our initial mistakes? And that is something that we all have to keep in mind as we watch policy and watch how our government decides to take action in that or any other part of the world.
CBS News correspondent, journalist Kimberly Dozier, a walking, talking miracle. Kimberly, it truly is an honor to have you on this program. It's a joy to hear your voice. Thank you so much. Thank God you're alive. And look forward to talking to you again.
Sounds great. Good to talk.
Kimberly Dozier is the subject of a special this coming Tuesday night at 10 p.m. on CBS with Katie Couric. The title of the program is Flashpoint, and it explores in detail the story that you have just heard.
You've been listening to WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. The show can be heard every Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 o'clock on News Radio 1070 WINA. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. If you enjoyed the show, why not check out our site for hours and hours of archives of Coy's show? You'll also find other radio programs, arts features, public affairs coverage, and more.